Welcome to the May 21st hearing of the Senate Natural Resource, Environment and Natural Resources Committee. We have one bill up today, and that is House Bill 2186A, and I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2186A. And Beth, if you can provide us an overview.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2186A authorizes the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt following standards and requirements to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The low carbon fuel standard for gasoline, diesel, and fuels used as a substitute for gasoline or diesel declares an emergency is effective on passage. And just for the record, there was additional written testimony that has been submitted.
Okay. Thank you, Beth. And we have Andy Ginsberg from the Department of Environmental Quality to explain to us what this bill does and doesn't do. And thank you, Andy.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at DEQ, and I am here to provide information and to urge your support for House Bill 2186. This bill is designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It also will have benefits for economic development, save fuel, and reduce other air pollution. It includes a number of targeted measures that are designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector. And if I could draw your attention to the chart on the last page of my written testimony, you'll see that transportation accounts for about a third of the greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon. And so this bill addresses a pretty significant sector that's contributing to our greenhouse gas emissions. In the House, we had a quite robust public process to review this bill. We had over 60 stakeholders that attended numerous meetings, big, large group meetings, small group meetings, conference calls, to review the bill. And one measure of that is that we went from an initial bill as introduced that was only 35 lines long to the A. and Gross bill, which is now 186 lines long. So a lot more detail was added to address many of the specific concerns that were raised by stakeholders and legislators throughout the House process. With regard to greenhouse gases from the transportation sector, there's really three major approaches that we can take to reduce those emissions. One is to reduce the carbon intensity of the gasoline and diesel fuel itself, so that when you burn it, it emits less greenhouse gas emissions. The second is to improve the efficiency of vehicles so that they burn less fuel, essentially, as they're operating. And then a third would be to reduce the hours that a vehicle operates or the miles that it travels so that you're actually consuming less fuel that way as well. This bill provides specific authorities that are aimed at all three of those approaches for reducing greenhouse gas emissions from transportation. And those authorities are, with the amendments added in the House, are very specific and limited, and they include a number of protections for businesses that are affected and extensive provisions related to legislative oversight as we implement the bill. So what I'd like to do is walk you through as quickly as I can the provisions that are in the bill, highlighting the amendments that were made in the House to address those concerns, and also a few additional amendments that will be presented to you for consideration next week in the work session. So starting with the low carbon fuel standard, and I'll just refer you to section 3.2 in the bill on page 2, line 11. The purpose of the low carbon fuel standard is to reduce the life cycle greenhouse gas intensity of gasoline and diesel fuel used in transportation by 10% over 10 years from 2010 to 2020. It encourages the use of all types of low carbon fuels, but it doesn't mandate any specific fuel to be used. So it's very different from a renewable fuel standard that requires a certain percentage of biofuels to be blended. This standard requires the reduction, it sets a performance standard, requires a reduction in the life cycle carbon intensity of the fuel, but doesn't mandate how it will be met. Any type of low carbon biofuel can be used, as well as electricity, hydrogen, compressed natural gas, biogas, and other methods that may be used by the distributors of fuel. It considers the life cycle emissions, so you're not just the emissions from burning the fuel, but the emissions from all the way through the life cycle from when it's produced to it's stored and transportation. And so as a result, it favors biofuels that are made locally, those that are made from waste products like waste agricultural waste or forestry waste products locally would score the best in terms of life cycle greenhouse gas emissions. And so therefore, this standard could benefit with local development of local biofuels facilities and spur local economic growth, and also provide some protection from price spikes by diversifying the fuel supply, and also has a side benefit of reducing other air pollution from transportation. For example, with electric vehicles, you have lower toxic emissions, and lower emissions like benzene, for example. This standard has recently been adopted by California, and it is under consideration by a coalition of Northeast states. In the House, a number of safeguards were added to this provision. First of all, we clarified that it only applies to the distributor of gasoline and diesel fuel. It doesn't impose any requirements on electric companies or on biofuels producers. Although it does allow all types of fuels to be used to meet the standard, the requirement is on the distributor of gasoline and diesel. We clarified that the reduction is 10% over the time period 2010 to 2020, but it requires the Commission to defer the requirements if necessary because of shortages, for example, of biofuels that could cause price impacts. In addition, the House exempted propane and other low-volume fuels that are not significant with regard to transportation, and added provisions to ensure that any biofuels that are blended into a low-carbon fuel must meet quality specifications to protect engine warranties. On the House floor, when this bill was being debated, there were requests for several additional amendments. One is to ensure that the price of fuel in Oregon does not get out of line with the price in neighboring or, you know, nearby states within our region. We don't expect the low-carbon fuel standard to increase the cost of transportation fuel, and it's possible that it could even decrease the price a little. But as a safeguard, we're developing an amendment for your consideration that would require deferral of the requirements if we see the price going up significantly relative to neighboring states. We also had a subsequent request from stakeholders to include an exemption for interstate locomotives from the low-carbon fuel standard. It's not strictly necessary because federal law already preempts states from regulating interstate trains, but we don't have an objection to exempting fuel used in interstate trains from the standard that they are already exempted from California's standard, for example. You have a Dash 9 amendment that was not developed by DEQ that's a little broader than that, so we've developed an alternative amendment, or we're developing an alternative amendment that would just exempt fuel used in interstate trains. Moving on to Section 3.3, and I'll refer you to line 41 on page 2. This provision has to do, this is the one provision of the bill that does not have to do with transportation. It authorizes the Commission to set standards for products that contain high-potency greenhouse gases. So, for example, spray cans that use high-potency greenhouse gases as a propellant, or air conditioners that use high-potency greenhouse gases as a refrigerant. And the bill would, the A and Gross bill would authorize the Commission to set standards that limit the use of high-potency greenhouse gases in these products if safe and effective alternatives are available and if some other state has already acted to adopt a similar standard. During the discussion on the House floor, there was a request to remove this provision entirely from the bill because it doesn't relate to transportation and it's just a different issue than the rest of the bill. DEQ checked with California, and they're actually not very far along in developing standards for products like this, and so there's really no rush to adopt authority to move into these types of standards because there aren't that many for us to opt into at this point. So we are developing an amendment for your consideration that would just remove this section entirely from the bill. Section 3.3 has to do with fuel efficiency standards for trucks, and that begins it's section 3.4, and it begins on line 18 on page 3. And so commercial trucks, medium and heavy duty trucks, are a pretty significant part of that transportation pie that I referred to you to a little while ago. And there are many aftermarket devices that can be added to trucks that will reduce their use of fuel. The most common thing you'll see are fairings that are put on the front of a truck that divert the wind around the truck to reduce the aerodynamic drag. There are also fairings that can go on the sides and the backs of trucks. And then there are other things that can be done to reduce the rolling resistance of trucks. For example, single wide tires or low rolling resistance tires. And all of these devices end up improving fuel economy. And so by saving fuel, they save money. They also reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and they reduce associated toxic air emissions from diesel fuel combustion. The federal government, EPA, has packaged some of these strategies together into a program they call SmartWay, and it's a program aimed at shippers and carriers that encourages the use of these types of devices on trucks. And we're fortunate, actually, in Oregon, we have an organization called Cascade Sierra Solutions that is an official SmartWay provider. They are located in Coburg, and they have showrooms that are associated with truck stops. What they do is, in addition to promoting the use of these, they provide innovative financing where a trucker can get a loan, low interest or no interest loan from them, and then pay to cover the upfront capital costs of putting these devices on their trucks, and then use the fuel savings over time to pay back the loan. Since these are very cost-effective measures, they pay back quickly in the 1 to 3 year time frame. And then they can turn around and make a loan to another trucking fleet. So this bill would authorize the Environmental Quality Commission to require fleets to participate in the SmartWay program. And the safeguards that were added in the House were the first and most important one is to for the Environmental Quality Commission to ensure that financing, like I just described, is available. So the truckers don't have to come up with the upfront capital. There are loans available that can be used for the upfront cost and paid back with the fuel savings over time. The House also added a provision requiring the standards to be phased in over time, considering fleet size. So the largest fleets would be required first, but only as fast as financing is available. And so the result of those conditions together is that retrofits would only be required if they result in a net savings, that is, save enough fuel that the loan can be paid back. And that limits the types of trucks where these types of standards would make sense. So if you're putting on retrofits to reduce aerodynamic drag, they have their most benefit for trucks that spend a lot of time operating at freeway speeds. So long-haul trucks that are operating on the freeway most of the time will have the most benefit from these and are the most likely to have fuel savings that could be paid back with the loans. In contrast, trucks that are not spending much time on the freeway, that are, you know, may travel a little on the freeway, but they're primarily service vehicles or local delivery vehicles, are not going to get much benefit from aerodynamic retrofits. So as a result of that, DEQ clarified in the House that these aerodynamic retrofits are not going to be required, for example, on consumer-owned utility service vehicles. During the House floor discussion, there was also a request for some additional amendments, which we're drafting for your consideration next week. And the most important one is a case-by-case deferral from the truck efficiency standard. So even if we determine that financing is available and that in this type of truck fleet it would be possible to pay back the loans very quickly with fuel savings, there might be an individual trucking fleet where that's not the case. For example, let's say one of their major shippers is not operating because the economy is down and they're not able to, half of their trucks are sitting in a parking lot not being used. They wouldn't obviously be able to pay back the loan. So in that type of scenario, the amendment that you'll consider next week would allow for a case-by-case deferral of the requirements and only apply it where it makes sense and where savings would be material. We also will have an amendment that will exempt farm and log trucks from the requirements. The farm trucks are already exempt under existing Oregon law, but this amendment would make that more explicit. And then we would also add an exemption for log trucks, which are not good candidates for aerodynamic controls anyway. Then moving on to the next parts of the bill, sections 3.5 and 3.6. These provisions have to do with passenger vehicles and light-duty trucks. And the original bill, as we introduced it, had authority for the commission to restrict the sale of replacement parts that would increase the emissions of a vehicle as compared to how it was when it was originally manufactured. The original amendments were not that well defined and resulted in quite a bit of opposition from vehicle parts manufacturers and tire manufacturers. We worked closely with them and actually worked out an amendment that's acceptable to the Special Equipment Manufacturers Association and the National Tire Manufacturers Association called the Rubber Manufacturers Association, or RMA. And as a result of these amendments, we received letters from both of those organizations withdrawing their opposition to this bill. We split the requirement into two separate sections. The first one in Section 3.5 basically requires, opts into an existing certification program that California already operates. If you replace a motor vehicle part that is used on the emission control system of a car, for example, let's say it's your catalytic converter and it wears out and you're buying a new catalytic converter, the new one has to perform at least as well as the one you're replacing. And in California, they've got a certification process to ensure that that's the case. All of the manufacturers are set up with offices in Sacramento designed to be able to get those certifications or exemptions from California. And the manufacturers requested that we not create a duplicative system in Oregon, that if something is certified in California, it would be okay in Oregon as well. And that meets our requirements and meets theirs. With regard to tires, the tire manufacturers told us that California is working on tire efficiency standards. This has to do with the rolling resistance of tires. And so if you reduce the rolling resistance of a tire, you can improve the fuel economy and thereby save fuel and also greenhouse gases. The tire manufacturers told us that once California adopts a tire efficiency standard, it will essentially become a de facto national standard because they're not set up to supply one type of tire to California and another type of tire to Oregon and Washington and other states. So they essentially said, we'll get those tires whether or not we adopt these standards. And so that means that this authority that's in this bill is really backup authority in case in the future the marketing and distribution practices change and they do try and market lower performing tires in Oregon, we can require the same type of tires that are sold in California to be sold here. And these tires can improve fuel economy by up to 5%. In the House, added a number of additional safeguards. First of all, the tire standards would only apply to new replacement tires, not to retreads and not to an existing tire that's on an existing car. There are a number of exemptions, for example, specialty tires that are made in small batches for certain types of uses. Snow tires, spare tires, motorcycle tires, off-road tires are all exempt. And also, the tire standards have to be cost-effective. They can't affect tire safety. They can't reduce the life of tires, and they can't increase our problems with managing scrap tires. So there are many, many protections, but the most important one is that we can't adopt a different tire standard just for Oregon. We can opt into a tire standard that another state, such as California, has adopted.
Okay. Andy, can I ask you to wrap up? Because
yes.
We have a lot of people that want to testify.
Okay. So then let me run just quickly on the tire. The next section has to do with tire inflation. Keeping tires well inflated is also important. And we amended in the House that to require to be clear that this doesn't apply to if the requirement is that when your car is in for service, otherwise to get your oil change, for example, that your tire would be inflated as part of that service. It doesn't require, if you're just pumping gas, it doesn't require a service provider to buy a compressor if they don't have one. The last provision of the bill has to do with idling. And I'll just say the protections added in the House ensure that idling is allowed whenever it's necessary for operating electrical or mechanical equipment on a vehicle. It's also allowed whenever necessary for loading, unloading, being stuck in traffic, any type of normal operation. And to the extent that idling restrictions apply to ships or ports, we're required to work closely with the ports and take into account the special consideration, operating considerations of Oregon's ports. And Madam Chair, if I could just briefly wrap up, talk about a few overall safeguards added to the bill. We're required in developing implementing rules to report to the interim committee and to the next three legislative sessions on our development of the rules. The rules cannot go into effect until after the 2011 legislative session. All the authority to adopt new regulation sunsets in the year 2020. Requirements have to be, in addition to following the normal Administrative Procedures Act, have to be safe, feasible, cost-effective, result in a net greenhouse gas reduction, and not have any negative impacts on health or the environment. And we need to consider what rules other agencies may be developing for reducing greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector to make sure we're not being duplicative. We will have one additional amendment in this area for you to consider, and that would be to require us to evaluate technical and economic studies that have been conducted about these standards and develop additional studies as necessary. So with that, Madam Chair, sorry, I went a little bit long. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. Thank you, Andy. And we'll take a few questions. I know you're going to be here if there are other questions to follow up. I will let you know that we are going to go till about 4:45 today. We're going to use a timer because we have a lot of people that like to testify, and if we don't get to hear everybody today, we'll roll over onto next Tuesday since we are not in session on Monday. But with that, there are questions. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Andy, a question. You said at the beginning of your testimony there was, you know, economic benefits, so on and so forth. When we heard SB 80, I think it's economic development, put forth a 3- or 4-page analysis of what the positive gains were and negative gains. Do we have anything on this, or has your agency done an economic analysis to say what's it, we're going to create jobs, lose jobs, how much is it going to cost, what's the benefit, how much carbon do we save, so on and so forth? What kind of analysis do we have?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, we have not done our own analysis at this point because we don't have the authorities in these bills, but all of these strategies are being considered or have already been adopted by other states. We're able to review the analyses that they have done. With regard to, and all the strategies have side benefits that provide these economic positives. So with regard to the low carbon fuel standard, the analysis that California did, the University of California at Berkeley, as well as the California Air Resources Board, have shown that the standards are not going to increase the price of fuel and can spur the development of local biofuels facilities, and that's where the benefits come from. Also diversifying the fuel supply. With regard to the truck efficiency standards, obviously it's the fuel savings, the net fuel savings that results in the benefits. As we get into developing specific regulations to implement this, we will have thorough economic analysis of the actual implementing rules. Overall, though, the reductions from this will exceed 10% because just the low carbon fuel standard in and of itself will get a 10% reduction.
Okay, follow up.
I would like to see some of those studies if you could drop me a look at it. Here's a practical cost question for you, and I don't know the answer, and you might not know the answer. I might have to get back to him, but I know I have a diesel truck, and I can get easily 2 to 3 miles per gallon more out of the diesel truck if I do some modifications to it, which are easily available on the market, and if I do those, General Motors voids my warranty. So I can't do those. When you start talking about modifications and things to trucks, does the commercial industry face the same warranty problems? I mean, for me, it'd be great if I could get 3 more gallons out of my diesel, but considering it's General Motors and I don't know when they're going to go under, I need the warning.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, for the commercial trucks, there's no modification of the engine or the emission control equipment. It's adding fairings that affect the and skirts that affect the aerodynamics, and it's also, for example, putting on double wide tires. And none of those things would affect warranties.
Yeah, Madam Chair, would I follow up offline on the economic analysis here of, you know, what have we assessed, what have we not assessed, and what do we think it's going to cost?
Yes, and if you can share that with Beth, we can get that out to the entire committee. Are you done?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Senator Hess?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that note on trucks, are these Oregon, registered in Oregon trucks?
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, the way that California has established the requirement, it applies to trucks that operate within California. The bill doesn't require us to implement it that way, but my expectation is that we probably would. So it's not a matter of where they're registered, but it's a matter of where they operate.
So how would that work if, you have an out-of-state trucking firm based in Texas or Washington or something coming through Oregon?
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, are you asking like how would we enforce it?
Yeah.
The initial implementation is primarily through outreach. There's a provision in the bill that allows us to require dealers that sell trucks and that sell these parts to advertise the requirements, and that's how we would start. We also have the benefit that California's rule is already in place, and many of the trucks that operate in Oregon do travel to California. They're already subject to these requirements. And so also we will be starting, because of the way the amendments put in the House, starting with the largest fleets and working our way down. So it's not a matter of everybody will be affected all at once, but the larger fleets that we can easily identify and contact will be affected first.
And then
follow up,
please. If it could be, there are Oregon trucking firms who don't operate in Oregon and they wouldn't have to be subjected to, tires or aerodynamic
requirements.
Correct. If I could follow up.
Follow up.
On coordination, what does this mean, that the commission coordinates Oregon standards with those of other states? Does that mean you'll just take what they do, or if they don't do anything, we won't do anything? Or what's the practical meaning of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, the purpose of that is to, as much as possible, provide, and that provision only applies to the low-carbon fuel standard, but the idea is to have as much as possible uniform requirements, and we're hoping that the state of Washington will follow suit if we adopt a low-carbon fuel standard, so that the fuel suppliers will have similar requirements from state to state. That we are in different fuel distribution regions, and many of the biofuels, for example, are not blended at the refinery. They're blended at the rack, and so it's possible for each state to be different. But it's beneficial, I think, for the overall development of biofuels in our region if we have similar requirements. So, for example, we have in the bill the requirement to reduce by 10% by the year 2020. If California, for example, decides that they need to defer that to 2021, or 9.8% is a better number based on the availability of biofuels, we want the ability to make those types of adjustments.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Question, Senator Prasansky?
Yeah, I want to follow up on what Senator Haas was saying. Regarding this interstate commerce, I guess the phrase is operating within the state. You want to define that for us?
Madam Chair, Senator Prasansky, it would just be that if the trucks are operating on Oregon highways, they would be operating within the state.
If you got a truck that's coming from Washington State, Seattle, going to L.A., going through the state, you're saying that we are going to be able to somehow regulate and require them to meet these standards?
Madam Chair, Senator Prasansky, if they're going into California, they'd already have to be meeting these standards. But
another state,
pick another state, and yes, that would be the requirement.
So, but we wouldn't be in violation with interstate commerce, interfering with something that's going through the state.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, probably an attorney should answer that question because we'll be very careful as we are implementing the rules to make sure we don't violate any federal interstate commerce requirements. But my understanding is that no, as long as we apply the standards uniformly to any in-state versus out-of-state trucks, that we wouldn't be in violation of any interstate commerce requirements.
All right, follow up. Yeah, regarding these trucks or operators that would be potentially eligible for some type of exemption, or whether they're going to be required to adopt the standards such under the bill. Who makes those determinations?
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, that the Environmental Quality Commission would first adopt criteria based on the requirements that will be in our amendment, which will be fairly specific. The amendment will lay out the payback periods that have to be met in order for the requirements to be imposed, and if those payback times can't be met, then a deferral would have to be issued. The Environmental Quality Commission, in adopting the implementing rules, would lay out in more detail the procedures that we would use at the department for making those case-by-case determinations. So the overall provisions will be in the amendment that you'll be considering next week, and then the details will be in the rules.
Any follow-up?
I'll hold off for now.
Okay, Senator Gokas, you
have a question? I have a follow-up based on Senator Przanski and Senator Haas's questions. You made reference to in the coordination, we coordinate with California with their standards, and then likewise with Washington. I think Washington legislature said no. They're in an assessment process up there. California's broke as of yesterday, and they may be reducing some of their standards in order to just in their enforcement in order to simply balance their budget. So does the coordination go two ways, so that if sort of California, you know, we have a threshold here and they reduce their threshold, are we going to float with them in that coordination, or are we going to be an island that doesn't get much freight already?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, I'm not aware that a California is planning on changing their low-carbon fuel standard as a way of addressing their budget concerns. But if they do change their low-carbon fuel standards, we will evaluate it carefully, because if the same conditions apply in Oregon, we're going to want to make this a similar type of assessment. The oil industry has been working in California with California for a couple of years in developing this, and I'm sure as they work with us, they'll bring all of that experience that they gained in spending all that time with California to the table in our rulemaking advisory committee, and we'll want to set up our process to take advantage of the benefits of all that experience. So, yes, it will go both ways. On the other hand, I also want to say it's important that we provide economic certainty for biofuels developers. So that one of the important goals of this is to incentivize the development of local low-carbon biofuels, especially cellulosic ethanol and other biofuels that are made from waste products that'll be low-carbon. And in order for those types of facilities to get financing, it's going to be important for them to know that the standard will be in place and will stay in place. So the adjustments will be around the edges. For example, if a plant goes down and there's a shortage of supply, or if a plant is being built and it won't be ready until a year later, we can make adjustments to make sure that we have adequate supplies. But we're not anticipating that we'd have a year-to-year significant changes in what the standards would be.
Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you very much, Andy. Stick around in case there's some other questions. Okay, we're going to start calling up folks, and we have our timer set for 2 minutes. If you have written testimony, I'm going to ask people to hand it in, please, and we will be adhering to this time limit because we have a lot of people here. And as I mentioned, if we need to, we'll roll this over to next Tuesday. With that, I'm going to call up Marion Haynes, Chris Bacon, is that right, and Barbara Crest.
Will their staff people get more than our operating budget for each office?
Okay, why don't you go ahead and get started?
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes. I'm with the Oregon Business Association. The Oregon Business Association supports House Bill 2186. We did have some amendments that our group would like to see put in place here on the Senate side, but was supportive of moving the bill over here. We have been working with DEQ and others on those amendments that you should see next week, and expect that after review that we will be able to fully support the bill. But at this point, we do think that the state should move forward with examining this. The amendments that we're most concerned about have to do with fully evaluating the economic impacts of this, along with the environmental and greenhouse gas reduction impacts of that bill. So we look forward to seeing those. And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Bakken, here in support of Senate House Bill 2186. I am the President and Chief Strategy Officer of Synchro Motive, LLC, a small Portland company focused on building power electronics components for electric vehicles, electric transportation, and products to improve fuel economy on transit buses and freight hauling trucks. I support, and my company supports, 2186 because it's a foundation piece in creating Oregon jobs. There are numerous companies here in Oregon focused on this area, and I think they need support. Quite frankly, there is no incentive in investing in high carbon fuel standards. That is the I don't see any other alternative. We've been doing that for a long time, and it's not working out all that well, and it doesn't bring jobs, and it doesn't bring employment to Oregon.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am not Barbara Crest, but I do play her on TV and during public hearings. My name is Darrell Fuller, and I represent the Northwest Auto Trades Association. Barbara is our executive director. We had significant concerns with the original version of 2186. It was very broadly written and, in fact, caused a lot of concerns from national auto parts manufacturers in terms of how the DEQ was going to go about choosing which aftermarket parts would be acceptable in Oregon and which ones wouldn't be acceptable in Oregon. As a result of some phone calls and some work group meetings that we participated in, DEQ successfully narrowed the scope of the bill through the amendments on the House side that made it real clear that Oregon wasn't going to be setting its own standards. It was going to be partnering with other states, primarily California, agreeing with standards that are already preset in another state like California, where they have the resources to do the testing and to do the due diligence with the manufacturers on parts that alleviated a lot of our concerns. And then a fairly small change that was important to us in this economic climate, and that was having to do with inflating the tires when vehicles are in on service. And we don't have any problem with mandating that our members do that when they have vehicles in for service. What we didn't want is for the state to mandate that if a repair facility didn't have that kind of equipment available, they'd have to go out and buy it in an economy where they may be trying to keep everybody employed. And so they were able to put a provision in the bill that limited the tire inflation part of it to just those businesses that already had that equipment available to them. So with the amendments narrowly addressing our concerns, it eliminated our concerns, and so we don't have any problems with the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your comments on that. And are there any questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you. And just note for the record that Barbara Crest submitted written comments, but Darrell Fuller actually gave them in oral form. Okay, next up we have Ralph Groner, Bob Olson, and Chris Ullum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner. representing AFSCME and the AFSCME Environmental Caucus. We're here in support of House Bill 2186. I've given you written testimony, so I won't prolong your anguish over my testimony, only to say that, to me at least, not only the issues we raise in our literature in support of 2186, but what occurs to me is people either believe in global warming or they don't, so I'm not going to solve that with my testimony. I can tell you that our union does believe in what harm greenhouse gases have done, and those who don't believe in it, God bless them, but we're here to try to do all we can. Secondly, one thing I have become very knowledgeable in working with DEQ is the health hazards due to diesel pollution, and all I'll say on that is I wish that we would retrofit every diesel truck because it causes cancer and it causes asthma, and it's on a traumatic increase for young people, and especially why OHSU has now become a diesel-free institution, the first of its kind in the country. Energy independence, I don't need to mention. I would hope everybody agrees we no longer can rely on Middle East oil and have my kids and my grandkids going to war for oil. And new jobs such as biofuel facilities at the local level, and complement the kinds of work that you just did in this committee in 2671 to retrofit garbage trucks in the entire metro area. By the way, that reduces our pollution up where I live by 10%. And those are the kinds of things collectively, not just this bill, we need to do. One problem area, I look at the Port of Portland, and I've learned through years of following this, we have hundreds of diesel trucks idling while they're waiting to load the trucks. That does irreparable cost to the truck owner of that firm or the individual, but it also has a dangerous impact on air pollution with diesel pollution, which is particulates compared to automobiles. Okay. And those, so I only want to say that, yes, my union wholeheartedly backs 2186. I do believe that it's not as widespread authority as everyone in the building likes to tell me about polar bears and so forth. I've been chewed out mightily by fellow unions and by other legislators. We're here proudly and not somewhat courageously. We believe the right thing to do is to support 2186. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gruner. Mr. Ullum.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Ullum. I'm the President and CEO of Plastifuel Corporation. I'm here in support of House Bill 2186. Plastifuel is a four-year-old startup company, two Oregon State graduates, and quite simply we have a distributed technology that takes mixed waste plastic and makes crude oil out of that plastic. And we have our first plant running just up north at Agroplast Incorporated. My experience in 4 years of running this company and four rounds of funding is that there's three things that are really enabling the clean tech revolution. One is technology and innovation. Another is financing and the venture capital community and angel funding. And the third is policy. And I'm here to say that policy is an integral part of that. Policy has created industries like wind and solar. And then you see the cost coming down once you have those policy incentives. It's my belief that the benefits of this are going to be met definitely on the environmental side, jobs and energy security. Plastifuel, as far as the environmental, because we put the technology where the waste is and not moving the waste to the technology, we eliminate transportation to landfills. We don't fill up our landfills and our oceans with waste plastic. We don't unnecessarily move waste to incinerators or landfills. We don't have to import as much oil, and all of that equals less carbon footprint. With respect to jobs, if you take just how much waste plastic is generated every year in Oregon, after all of our recycling efforts, there is enough waste plastic that we generate just in Oregon to generate over 500,000 barrels of oil per year in rural jobs in throughout Oregon. That's 22 million gallons of oil per year that we could generate today through this type of technology, and along the way create about 1,500 rural jobs, operator jobs, 24/7 running plastic fuel type equipment. that's the kind of impact that this can have, and that's why I'm in support of this bill.
Thank you. Thank you for coming here, gentlemen. Any questions for these witnesses? And Senator Brzozinski.
Chris, regarding the type of plastic on the recyclables 1 through 7, which ones can or can't be used?
Thank you for the question, Senator. All types of plastic can be processed, including the problematic ones and threes, PET and PVC. That's the virtue of our technology. No sorting or pre-characterization of the feedstock is required. And either way, regardless of what goes in, we get a good, clean crude oil that we're already selling to a refinery in Tacoma, Washington.
One other question, if I could. Caps, since the caps usually can't be recycled, can they also go in there?
Yeah, generally those are polypropylene, and that's right. You don't need to take them apart. We don't need to send it to China to let the Chinese low-cost labor do that. We can keep that energy here and not waste the carbon footprint of transporting waste across the oceans.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Broquist.
You said you're selling the crude oil now. What's the cost per gallon or cost per barrel? What's the economics of it?
Yeah, thank you, Senator. The cost, our production cost right now is $42 per barrel. It's not incredibly compelling if oil is, down below 50. It's at 60 today, but any policy advantages have a big impact on this industry, just like in the wind and the solar and the biofuels industry.
Okay. Any other questions? Great. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You. Appreciate your time.
Okay. I am going to call up North Cheatham, who's from Hood River. I forgot to ask, is there anybody else here from 100 miles away? Or I see that there is about 99% lobbyists on the sheet, and I know that most of you can come back. Is there anybody here who cannot come back on next Tuesday?
Senator Dingfelder and members of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify once again. I'm not affiliated with any environmental organization or industry group. I argue for issues on the in the interest of the public public interest. We all must share the burden, and there's no reason any one industry should be exempt from the responsibility to cut down on global warming. A lot of the provisions of this bill, I see, are actually, others have testified, they are cost-saving after the initial investment. Therefore, they make a lot of sense. For example, the tire inflation requirement is simply common sense. It's a no-cost, no-brainer. The other things, such as the low-carbon fuel requirement and so forth, may not be a direct benefit to the trucking industry, but it is certainly a benefit to the public interest. The other things, such as reducing drag by aerodynamic fairing and skirts, only make sense in terms of a long-term investment that will be paid off over time. Highway use is a privilege, not a right. We all hear that from DEQ, I would maintain that that is also an issue here. We all strive to avoid adding costs and discourage excessive regulations to our operations. I certainly know about that. I have owned a Kenworth tractor-trailer rig to transport fruit up and down the West Coast. I've also owned a farm vehicle, 18,000-pound farm vehicle. And I will just say in passing it that it is in our best interest, all of us, to do what we can to enhance energy security and global warming by maximizing energy efficiency. Please pass this bill.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Cheatham? All right, thank you for coming out today from Hood River. And now we'll start going down the list, and hopefully we'll be able to get most folks in. Brian Dougherty, Bob Russell, Paul Romaine, come up. We'll call you up, Barry. You can't come back next week. We'll call you up next. Okay.
I hope the weather
is
good.
Yeah, well,
it will, farmer, be.
It will be.
Good afternoon. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, Brian Dougherty here testifying on behalf of the Western States Petroleum Association. I wanted to bring up a few points based on some of your questions and talk to you a little bit about this. The Western States Petroleum Association is trying to find the right pathways to reach 2020 goals, both in California, Oregon, Washington, and other places. One thing we don't feel is that LCFS is the right way, the low carbon fuel standard is the right way to do that. I appreciate Mr. Ginsburg's comments that he really enjoys the benefits of talking with us and all our experience in Sacramento. We certainly will keep working with him. However, I would like to provide a few things. One, Sierra Research has come out with a study just last month that says that the California low carbon fuel standard will cost California taxpayers $3.7 billion per year by the year 2020. That is in stark contrast to the CARB research that said it will save people money. I'll provide that to you. I know Representative Edwards mentioned they want to put a cap on the cost of fuel. If it gets too high, we would stop something. I just want to briefly mention that we have a serious problem with that. I don't think it works for consumers well at all. I will address that with Representative Edwards, but we have a lot of concern with that off-ramp that they're trying to deal with. Also, DEQ has an amendment that was supposedly addressing studies. Again, DEQ will not use the words that they'll conduct any studies here. They agree to the word evaluate, which I think is very watered down. We think it's extremely important that you have the tools and that DEQ conduct the studies that will give you the answers about the economics of a low-carbon fuel standard and report back in 2011. Finally, we have done amendments to Senate Bill 80 that would allow our industry and utilities to fund some of the positions that would use to study or to administer the Climate Change Coordinating Council that's in part of the Senate Bill 80. That might be a bill that should be amended into 2186 or considered as an alternative, and we could have some help there. We're trying to put our money where our mouth is. We think studies are important. We have an LCFS already in Oregon. That is the E10B2. Only Minnesota has the same. When you pass 3463, you'll have that low-carbon fuel. And finally, I want to just say the Washington executive order signed today by Governor Gregoire asked Washington to conduct a study of the LCFS. We are tied to Washington far more than California. We have 85% of our fuel comes from Washington. And today they announced that they're doing, by executive order, a LCFS study. Thank you very much.
And, Brian, if you can follow up at the end about the copy of this study that you mentioned that versus the
CARB. The Sierra Research? Yes, I will.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Association, and I'm just going to talk about a few specific parts of this bill. The low-carbon fuel standard concerns us a great deal. Any fluctuation in fuel prices sort of causes us to go elsewhere. Most of the trucks that are, in fact, operating on Oregon highways are from other states. A truck can hold up to 300 gallons of diesel fuel, which will propel it about 1,800 miles. And trucks from other states, the cost of fuel is a penny or two higher in Oregon as a result of the low-carbon fuel standard, will fuel up in other states and go right on through Oregon. What that does is it puts a burden on my members that live here that have to buy their fuel in Oregon. They will have to pay for more expensive fuel even when they're operating interstate because they're in Oregon. And that causes us a tremendous concern. We are very concerned about the aerodynamic devices and the way this would work. Today was the first that I heard that this was going to apply to all trucks operating in Oregon. We have approximately 301,000 trucks over 26,000 pounds that operate in Oregon. 50,000 of those trucks are Oregon registered. The rest of them are from other states and even countries. I'm not sure how you administer this in Canada, because there's lots of Canadian trucks that will be operating in Oregon. I'm also very concerned that it would be implemented based on fleet size. That can cause some real competitive distortions within our industry if one fleet, because of its size, has to spend the money to do this while smaller fleets do not. They're going to have a competitive advantage in the marketplace. We're also concerned about the idling provisions. Today there's about 250 spaces at truck stops that are equipped with electric plug-ins, putting in the infrastructure to allow all the trucks to plug in so they can turn off their engine is going to be horrendously expensive.
Okay, thank you. And this is your written testimony, correct? Is that your written testimony?
Written testimony actually is the other document that you received. Because all of these things are coming from California.
Okay, so whose is this?
That is from the coalition.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Association and the Oregon People's Utility Districts Association. We submitted PUD testimony to you, and I just want to comment on a couple of things that have been raised. I echo the remarks made by the two at the table with me. One thing that is always fascinating to me is when a state agency tells you that they have a way to save you money. Businesses look for ways to save money. If we felt that any kind of retrofitting of a truck would save us in fuel, we would be doing it. That's just logical. So if it would save us money, it's great, and we will do it, whether you pass legislation or not. We believe this will cost us lots of money. Second thing is low-carbon fuel. What is that? We're still trying to figure that out. Ethanol, the carbon footprint from a lot of the ethanol that's around today is higher than gasoline in California. There's ethanol that's produced in Brazil, which has a very low carbon footprint. It's made from sugar beets. The problem is, as one of the articles I pointed out to you or sent out to you there, it's caused an increase in slavery problems in the production of ethanol in Brazil. Nobody's really done any analysis of this. We would like to see you adopt the Representative Boone's amendments, where we actually analyze this thing first before we give rulemaking authority to an agency. It's the logical way to go, and we would support that. One final thing that was brought up, I believe Senator Przanski, there is definitely a Commerce Clause problem with trying to affect trucks in other states. Because they operate in Oregon doesn't mean you can just simply slap on a requirement on them, because it affects their operation in another state. So you have a very serious problem whether you can regulate the vast majority of the trucks that even operate here. And if you do regulate the Oregon trucks, you've now put us at a competitive disadvantage. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Are there any questions for this panel? Senator Boquist?
Quick question. In short revenue times, I heard somebody say revenue out there.
his ears perked up.
Yes, right. You made mention the Governor Gregoire's issued her executive order, and they're going to do an assessment in the north. And I think somebody said something about maybe industry would be willing to assist in financing such an assessment or study.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, what I mentioned is amendments to Senate Bill 80, in which there is some funding possibilities through the Department of Energy to staff the Climate Change Coordinating Council, I believe it's what it's called, and perhaps staff a study through FTEs or personnel from the Department of Energy.
The U.S. Department of Energy?
No, the Oregon Department of Energy.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, next up, Tom Barrows, Dave Anser, and we'll have Henry Kramer come up.
Do you want the railroads all to come?
Yeah, is there more than two of you?
Cindy Rollins was signed up with me.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry about that. Yeah, Cindy, why don't you come up? And Henry, why don't you hold off for a minute? Why don't you get started?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Barrows, representing BNSF Railway. We're here urging you to adopt the Dash A9 amendments, which would exempt railroad locomotives from the low-carbon fuel requirements of the bill. We were exempted from the biodiesel bill last session because the manufacturers have said that if any these fuels are put into the locomotives, the warranty is void. And so we urge you to adopt.
You guys all, you're all asking for exemption. You're representing all different companies.
Correct.
Yep.
The amendment would apply to all railroads.
Yep.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Cindy Robert representing Union Pacific Railroad. You did hear Mr. Ginsburg say earlier, though, that he thought that should be narrowed to just the Class 1 lines. And Union Pacific, as well as BNSF, would say that that's not true. The exemption that was provided in 2007 for biofuels applied to all locomotives. And this bill, for purposes of policy and parallels and fairness to all rail lines, should, in fact, include all rail lines in Oregon. We use the same suppliers, we use the same services, we use the same vendors, and the same rules should apply, especially with the federal preemption that we already live under. And I do want to assure you, I've just passed out a sheet, Madam Chair, that details a lot of the things that Union Pacific Railroad is doing to have cleaner, greener locomotives. We've come a very long way. And I won't read that to you. I won't offend you with that. But I hope that you take the time to read it sometime, because it's very impressive what Union Pacific is doing.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Anser. I'm with the Portland Western Railroad. We're a short line railroad here in northwest Oregon. We operate about 500 miles of railroad. I'd like to thank Cindy for her comments. We were concerned about not being exempt, having our locomotives not be exempt on this bill. We would like to have all the locomotives be exempt. Portland Western has been working with DEQ to try to make our engines more efficient. We applied for a grant under the EPA with ARR funds to change a couple, repower two locomotives to increase the fuel efficiency of those and reduce fuel emissions by about 25% to 50% on each of those locomotives. So we're already taking some of these initiatives on our own, and we appreciate DEQ's efforts. We're just concerned about some of the way it's written in the bill, and we'd like to see that amendment for all locomotives.
And we don't have the dash nines.
You do, they're in your packet, and they're also in the back of the room.
All right, I didn't see it in my... So I'm assuming it's in here somewhere. I have a question for any one of you, or if all three of you want to answer. Idling. We have addressed idling in trucks, and we heard a little bit from the truckers about that. Can you talk about what you're doing to reduce your idling? And because it's a concern that I have, that we want to make sure and address.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Anser. I'm the Director of Finance and Accounting for Portland Western. I'm also a locomotive engineer. We have rules out there for idling locomotives. If a locomotive is going to sit for more than 15 minutes, our rules say that you have to shut it down. We, our train masters, the managers that are out there to regulate those employees, mandate that those locomotives do get shut down, and we do periodic checks to make sure that does. That's more of a fuel conservation policy to save fuel and save costs, and since we're a small business, we have to take those measures. I know Union Pacific and BNSF also have taken those steps. They have locomotives that automatically shut down if they're idle for 15 minutes or more on some of the lower, newer locomotives.
And this is a federal requirement?
No, it's not.
No, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Cindy Robert, Union Pacific Railroad. Union Pacific not only has new locomotives that have an automatic start-stop program, so we're not doing idling, we're also retrofitting all our old engines. So this idling piece is a concern of ours. And in our yards, which is where a lot of the idling happens, we're switching to genset exchange instead of using the locomotives to move our trains around so that we don't have those idling problems. It's an issue we are addressing.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Did you want to add anything?
We're addressing it as well, Madam Chair.
Senator Boquist?
I just have a question. You might not have the answer to this. I'm just wondering, tonnage moved on rail versus truck tonnage looking for fuel consumption?
Yeah. The American Association of Railroads put the standard out for, or does the study for all railroads. Excuse me, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And those figures are about 430 miles per ton mile. For 1 gallon of fuel being burned. So we're about four times more efficient than a truck.
I follow up. I'd just be curious, at some point you can give me a reference of I know it's hard to find, how much tonnage is moved through Oregon on rail versus truck. So you can get a grasp of how much fuel you use compared to trucks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can't answer that question specifically, but I can say that we do handle, it's about four times more fuel efficient than a truck.
Right.
So we can handle about four times the load as a truck.
Right. I understand that. I was looking for tonnage, actual hauled tonnage.
Yeah, and I can't answer that.
Okay. We'll try to get that.
Thanks. Okay, thank you very much.
It's in here somewhere. I just can't see it.
No.
So I will get this to you by the end of the
day.
Okay,
and we did get the amendment, so we'll take a look at that. Thanks. Okay. So you can go ahead and pull up, and I'm going to have Henry just come up to a microphone, and Barry Bushy and Mark Nelson.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Henry Kramer. I represent the bus project.
I just want to briefly speak in favor of House Bill 2186. The bill uses common sense, cost-effective approaches to invest in energy independence and energy efficiency. A good deal of our work at the bus is organizing civically minded youth, so I just want to speak very briefly to how this bill will help the next generation inherit a stronger Oregon. Oregon's young people need to inherit a livable climate and work in a sustainable economy, something that's going to last beyond an up or down cycle. And this bill, while it doesn't kill the two proverbial birds of climate change and the recession, it certainly helps maim them a little bit with one stone. By enacting this bill, we can integrate our goals of fighting climate change with everyone's desire to emerge from this recession with a robust economy. Now, by considering the carbon life cycle of our fuel, we can both reduce our carbon emissions and provide a powerful boost to local jobs in our agricultural and natural resource sectors. And it'll help give a leg up to truly green fuels, to sort of speak on what Mr. Romain was saying. Truly green fuels like cellulosic ethanol with the low carbon fuel standard will be boosted, and we can produce that here through things like forest material and crops like switchgrass. That'll help stimulate our growing biomass industry. And by shifting our fuel mix from foreign oil to homegrown biomass, we can stabilize our gas prices, create good jobs, and improve our energy security. And I just want to thank you for the opportunity to testify and to urge you to pass this bill.
Did you retrofit your bus?
We, not as of yet, but the intention, Vice Chair Atkinson, the our intention is to do so. Maybe.
Kind of.
I can get back to you. We write that down.
Yeah.
Mr. Nelson.
About people like that.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, today representing Les Schwab. I should also say that I am also representing industrial customers, Northwest Utilities, Northwest Food Processors Association, and the Oregon Metals Industry Council. As you know, Les Schwab operates over 90 tire centers throughout the state. We employ 1,871 employees in our tire centers, distribution, and transportation departments. We feel we understand the state, and we certainly feel we understand the tire business. First and foremost, we fundamentally disagree with the delegation of authority to DEQ. We believe that the issues involved in this bill are more properly belong in this body, that the proper role of DEQ is to look at these areas that they intend to adopt rules for, to study those areas much in the same way that the Dash 5 amendments put forward by Representative Boone would do, where we recognize, we identify the cost, whether the amount of carbon that's going to be saved and the cost to the consumer and the cost to Oregon businesses, and we come forward with a plan which reflects those costs and bring that back to the legislature. The delegation of authority in this bill, we think, is quite mind-boggling, and the fact that DEQ is going to attempt to try to solve all these problems without and make these policy decisions without bringing back to you, we think are key. While we recognize the desire of the governor to move forward and DEQ to make headway in the issue of rolling resistance and CO2 emissions, we again are troubled with the bill. There is no standard in the industry defining tire rolling resistance. This is a complicated issue that's been under study for some time. A reference has been made to California. It has not been determined what those standards are going to be. The federal government is currently working on a consumer education campaign to educate consumers as to rolling resistance and the issue of carbon emissions. Finally, we don't think it's in the best interest of Oregonians to pass this bill without any kind of estimation of what is the right approach, how much it will cost the state, and how much CO2 will actually be reduced. Again, the issue of tire rolling resistance has not been decided. In terms of Section 3 and 4, as you've heard about the significant cost of retrofitting trucks, we operate over 400 trucks in Oregon to service our customers.
customers, along with a fleet of 80 semi-trucks transporting products to our states. The estimated cost, in fact, has been $5,000 to $15,000. In fact, Weyerhaeuser has just developed, went out and received some bids, actually received a bid on a retrofit of around $14,000. If you say it's someplace between $10,000 and $15,000, you're talking $400 to $600 million cost to Oregonians' truck fleet just operating in Oregon. That's 47,000 trucks, not to count the other 250,000 trucks that operate interstate. We believe that's a huge cost to Oregonians and certainly a cost to Les Schwab. Finally, we would respect that you do oppose 2186 and that you look at looking
Mr.
at
Nelson,
the
can you wrap it up, please? I need
the
to be
study
fair to
approach.
Everyone.
Finally, you haven't heard about the issue of consumer products, consumer and commercial products, which is also going to be regulated by this bill, by DEQ. And so it's not just tires. It's much more broader in terms of the authority that you're delegating. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Pursue.
Hello, for the record, my name is, Vice Chair Atkinson, members of the committee. My name is Barry Bashu. I'm president of the Oregon Farm Bureau and Farm near Boring, Oregon, and I'm here to represent the grain industry. I've heard a lot of discussion here about economic benefit and assertions that there'll be no increase in fuel costs, et cetera, and all those assertions are very good unless you're the guy that's got to pay the bills, and that's me, and that's the people I'm here to represent. And this bill, I cannot believe, I've moved rapidly from frustration by the fact that the House of Representatives passed this bill on to you folks and dumped it in your lap, and I've moved from frustration now to absolute disbelief. The discussions that have gone on here today, there's 242,550 people unemployed in the state right now. We're second in the nation in unemployment. So we have the silver medal, and I hope that our goal is not to look for the gold. There's no way, and our numbers of unemployed people have doubled in 12 months. People like me that employ people, try to employ people, try to simply pay bills, try to maintain a product, try to transport a product, and then to hear that this legislature is considering giving almost unfettered regulatory control to Department of Environmental Quality. Now, with all respect to those folks, they do a good job. They do the best they can within the budget limits they got. But to give them authority when all I hear so far is a lot more questions than I hear answers about the ultimate cost of this to people like me that are trying to create jobs in this state, green jobs in this state, with little, if any, recognition. Not for me personally, but the people I represent. If I sound frustrated, I am. I just cannot believe that we're sitting here talking about this in a national economy in a situation that we have right now where people are unemployed, and every one of these regulations is going to increase my costs and decrease my ability to keep my workforce in place. I've already laid off people that have worked for me for 18 years because of increased costs in a global economy that's in the tank. And here we're talking about a potential bill that will further increase these costs at what cost to the state, at what cost to the economy. And if our role model in this state is California, who months, weeks ago were on the basically in disruption and almost the brink of financial collapse, what are we doing here?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bushy. So, Mark, have you gone yet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank
okay,
you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next up is Brock Howell, Evan Manville, and Sandra Bishop.
Hey, Madam Chair, just for the record, if you buy tires from Les Schwab, they will rotate your tires for free and check your air anytime you come in to increase fuel efficiency.
I do know that. Thank you. And I really appreciate the one, especially in Ontario, where we got stuck.
Am I first?
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Brock Howell, and I'm a transportation advocate for Environment Oregon. We have 30,000 members statewide, and we work to protect clean air, clean water, and open space, among many other things. Okay. And I'm here to strongly support 2186. There are four main reasons why we think this is a good thing. One is the obvious of reducing global warming pollution. Transportation in Oregon amounts to more than a third of our global warming pollution. These, we've done an analysis of what at least a low carbon fuel standard and what the heavy duty truck improvements would do to help meet our 2050 goals. If we use 2030 as a benchmark, these would approximately help us get to about 16% from current policy to where we need to be for a 2030 benchmark. So that's a good metric. The low carbon fuel standard would reduce about 4.5 million metric tons. The heavy duty truck improvements would reduce 2.9 million metric tons of carbon dioxide by that time. The second reason why we support this is this saves money. Based off a California study, if we are able to extrapolate that to Oregon, it would save us approximately $1 billion. It would grow Oregon business. We have businesses here in this state that can help do these retrofits. In addition to the life cycle analysis of fuels, that means more of these fuels would be here in Oregon. And finally, this would be implemented safely with coming back or having the opportunity for the legislature to review what's happened thus far before the low carbon fuel standard is enacted. I would like to just mention with British Columbia was mentioned, their truckers are having to do some retrofits to help reduce the cost of meeting the carbon tax that they're facing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Helm. Sandra.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Sandra Bishop. I'm here today representing a company called Community Energy Systems. It's a renewable energy company with a lot of experience in several states with biomass projects, building small biomass projects. They are branching out into production of liquid fuels, looking at two different sites in Oregon. The kind of fuel standards that are in this bill are exactly the kind of things that's going to keep a company like this building in Oregon. We're talking here about biofuels and also synthetic diesels. These are renewable liquid fuels from interrupted waste streams. So there's a lot of cost figures thrown around and a lot of contentions about what this bill is going to cost the state. I can say that there is nothing more costly than the damage that's being done and will increase if we continue to release this many greenhouse gases into the atmosphere as we are now. So anything we can do to slow that down. And what I'm talking about here is locally produced fuel to be used locally. These synthetic fuels have very high octane content, so they're very good to mix with more traditional fuels, and you're simply going to get a bonus in that the total life cycle calculations are such that you're really cutting down on the carbon impact with locally produced fuels. In order to facilitate these private companies developing, the state has got to show that there's some sort of provision so that it's not going to be business as usual. Business as usual is going to drive these companies out of the state. They will simply build their plants elsewhere. We're talking about local jobs. We're talking about really decreasing pollution. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bishop. Mr. Manville.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Evan Manville. I'm representing the Oregon League of Conservation Voters and Oregon Conservation Network, a network of 40 organizations with over 100,000 combined members. Climate change is a huge problem for our economy and for our future. To tackle it, we simply need wedges. And some of those wedges, multiple things we have to do, are going to be hard, but these wedges in this bill should not be. These are well-studied, low-hanging fruit. A couple of points. First, the low-carbon fuel standard, similar to what California adopted and plan to be adopted by 11 Northeast states. If all of those folks do it, that's 100 million people in those states under a low-carbon fuel standard, about a third of the country. This isn't radical. The California standard was supported by Chevron, by Shell, by BP, by SoCal, by PG&E. It's not a radical step. It's a sensible, important step. Secondly, there's this ongoing mantra, there's no standard for low rolling resistance tires. Low rolling resistance tires have been studied since the 1980s. Car manufacturers have installed them on cars using engineering tests to increase their EPA mileage. The national standard will be adopted by December 2009 by NHTSA, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. So the fact that, you know, just to clarify what is known about low rolling resistance, and consumers should save about $150 in fuel costs over the lifetime of a tire set using low rolling resistance tires. Finally, reducing drag is simply smart economics. It's good for truck dealers and repair shops who are going to install this stuff. It's going to create jobs, and it's going to save truck companies money over the time. 2186, good for consumers, it's good for businesses, it's good for energy independence, and you may have seen the study that came out a couple of days ago, a bunch of former generals saying this is important for national security, that we wean ourselves off foreign oil. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel, Senator Boquist?
I just have a comment. I mean, I know a lot of former generals and they're well-intentioned, but at the same time, we've got to do something. Whatever we do is smart, and with half the state going towards unemployment, we also have to pay for it. So I think we need to keep that in mind.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chandler, I can't read that last name, Tammy Denis, and Jenna sorry if I'm mispronouncing, Caluza. Yeah, we just lost our hand. Okay, got it. Okay, and last up is going to be Paul Cosgrove, Jim Welch, and Chris Hagebomber.
We might actually make it.
Yep. Okay. Why don't you get going?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jenna Caluza, and I'm with NFIB. A lot of the concerns that we have already been mentioned, but I'm just going to highlight a couple for you today. The first being House Bill 2186 still includes language that allows the EQC to adopt requirements to maintain or retrofit medium-duty and heavy-duty trucks. We believe requiring retrofitting to trucks will increase the cost of doing business here in Oregon. The second is we are concerned with this level of delegation to DEQ that has been mentioned before. To allow DEQ to set standards for the greenhouse gas content of and use or disposal of consumer and commercial products, we believe that this delegation will prove costly, especially to small businesses. We support Representative Boone's amendments that were introduced on the House side, and in these economic times, we ask you to act cautiously before increasing the cost of doing business here in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tammy Denny. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. I hail from the great city of Pendleton each week to be with you here in the building. And
My husband will be with you all weekend for the Pendleton ride.
Oh, like wonderful.
The three-day ride.
We'll be up at the Wallowa Lake,
Don't run them over.
I wanted to be sure and echo some of the comments, the concerns that have been conveyed to you. I won't reiterate. You do have a copy of our written testimony. I do want to, however, though, point out for you some of the very specific issues that come to light for the farm community as we approach this issue and we attempt to craft solution. Our wheat producers and the trucks they move, because they have been identified and defined as interstate commerce movements, those are interstate commerce trucks. In the state of Oregon, currently we have over 18,000 F-plated trucks, and that number is a portion of that number is interstate commerce. And we're going to have to figure, there are big issues here that still have yet to be defined. And the lack of accountability from the EQC back to the legislative body before they implement rules really does create some pause for our industry, because we want to be certain that whatever policy decisions are made by you, the elected officials, as opposed to being made by an agency and then the elected officials set to the side and simply hearing the results of the rules they've made and implemented. But there's no recourse, no opportunity for redress through future sessions. And so we want to be sure that we're having a conversation that is about policy and what are the effects of the industry. The report that the way I read House Bill 2186, and maybe I'm simply misunderstanding, but the way I read it is the report that would come back to you from the Environmental Quality Commission is very simply a report without any accountability for stakeholders.
Okay.
So thank you very much. You have our written testimony, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Chandler.
Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the Committee, John Chandler for the Oregon Home Builders Association here in opposition to House Bill 2186. Also echoing the support for the Dash 5 amendment from the House. And I understand, particularly this session, the impetus and the need to do something, capital D, capital S, on this issue, but I'd submit that sometimes doing something consists first of figuring out what it is one ought to do. What the Dash 5 amendments that Representative Boone proposed would be to have the study done first, bring it back, figure out a path, and then go forward. What this bill does is set down a path that may or may not be the right one. It may or may not be economically feasible, and it certainly may or may not be good for this agency or for the economy. We understand the need. What we don't understand is why we're going to go off running headlong without figuring out what direction we're going in. We really do think that those amendments or something very similar to them is what this bill ought to turn into. With the specifics on the bill, as already mentioned, the products language may come out. That was our biggest concern since we build houses out of products. It's not our only concern. We do use trucks and trucking to bring goods to a job site if and when we ever have job sites again. That's of a concern to us. The impact on the state's economy, though, is, I think, needs to be analyzed. Someone mentioned the studies out of California. I did a quick Google of the AB 32 implementation down there, and I'll get you what I can. At the least, it is uncertain what the impact of AB 32, which is California's equivalent of this bill, has been. There's some peer-reviewed economics that economists have looked at it and said it doesn't really do what the cardboard said it would do. The economic impacts are not nearly as positive, and we need to be very cautious about emulating simply what California did. Finally, Madam Chair, members, I really think you should think about the impact on the agency. This agency has done wonderful work over the years, especially since Director Halleck was there. Mr. Peterson's taking on the role very well. This bill loves them to death. You look at all the maize in there and think about some of those maize turning to shalls and what the impact is given the fiscal or lack thereof that's been submitted on this bill, what that would do to the other programs of that agency. It could easily collapse it in terms of the other work they're doing, which is all very important and being done very well. This is an important issue. It's too important to be rushed through with this bill. We hope you will oppose it. Hope you move to the Dash 5s. Thank you for your attention. Be glad to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chandler. Any questions for this panel?
Quick question for Tammy. Tammy, you indicated about, I think, 17,000, 18,000 trucks like that, 4,000 farm families. That's roughly four trucks per farm family, and we'll just take $10,000 because that's the middle of the road to retrofit. So it would cost one of you, family farmer $40,000. To retrofit these trucks. How many years would it take to ever recover that amount of money he invested in those trucks?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, members of the committee, a retrofit investment of about $40,000, depending upon the market, depending upon the return on the market at any given time. On average, our growers feel very blessed to get to the end of a season, cash all of their checks, pay all of their bills, and have maybe $15,000 or $20,000 left at the end of all of the for a year's worth of work. So if they took that $40,000 and amortized it over some amount of time, they could absorb it, but it would take them a good deal of a number of years in order for them to fully factor that in. And I'm told recently one of my producers replaced two tractor tires for a couple of blowouts during spring planting season. Those tires cost $2,500 a piece. So currently, tractor tires are expensive. If we increase and incur additional costs, it's certainly going to create a burden for our growers
and their families.
And their families, absolutely.
All right, thank you very much. Our last panel, Paul Cosgrove, Jim Welch, and then we have Lisa Dotto, which left off. All four of you come up, please, and Chris Hagebaumer, and then we're shutting down in 11 minutes. You get going.
Madam Chair, Paul Cosgrove representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers and other manufacturers of consumer and commercial products, and thank you. I will be brief. I will make three points. Even if the commercial and consumer products section is removed, we still have concerns. Obviously, our products are moved by trucks and other modes of transportation. My concerns are, or my client's concerns are, about delegation. And it's not just delegation to DEQ and the Environmental Quality Commission. It's almost a double punt because, as you've heard and is logical, DEQ and EQC is going to rely heavily on agencies in the state of California. CARB, some of my clients have a lot of experience dealing with CARB, and CARB does not have the world's greatest track record in terms of being able to predict which technologies are possible, economical, and feasible, and sometimes sometimes going to the brink of deadlines and reversing themselves. So we're concerned that, in fact, the delegation goes beyond just to our own state agency, but they'll have to rely heavily on an agency in another state that has a not so great track record. Point number two, to the extent DEQ and EQC are making independent evaluations of these kinds of issues, I don't think they have, within their current capacity and current budget authority, the expertise necessary to do so. We're talking about evaluation of tire safety and the economics and financing of trucking and recovery of capital and fuel supply and availability. Those are not things within the agency's current purview, nor do I believe they have either the current staff or the funding to get staff that have expertise in those areas. And then point three is I'd like to suggest that you take a good look at the fiscal impact statement. It talks about how this can be done by sort of borrowing from other resources within the agency and that it isn't going to cost much. One of my clients, Alliance Automobile Manufacturers, is frankly the first and at the moment only example of how we have borrowed standards from California. And ironically, we had to borrow them lock, stock, and barrel with almost no exception. That cost the agency $400,000 a biennium. That's where we didn't make independent evaluation. So I just raise that as a concern about the fiscal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cosgrove. And can you just say on the record again who you're representing? I didn't catch
the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, and then there's several of other of my clients who do manufacturing of consumer products.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Welch.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, Jim Welch representing Oregon Cattlemen, Oregon State Grange, Beef Northwest, Taxpayers Association of Oregon. We're in opposition to this and have been all along. You know that there's an awful lot of the products for our rural industry, which is ranching and farming throughout the state. They're going to be faced with increased costs we see. The problem we have with this is we don't have any definitive and measurable outcomes. We just continuously hear mostly platitudes. We need a cost-benefit analysis. The cost-benefit analysis that we see is cost to us, to our individuals, families, and businesses. And we're required to make those changes so the cost is to us. And the benefits we see right now, yes, we've heard a lot about the benefits, and yes, we do think some of these measures will reduce some greenhouse gases. But we've been doing that for years and years and moving in that direction. So when we mandate this, it's going to be a direct cost to us. And those we have to remember those businesses that are bringing us products in the rural areas. Let's take a look at what the cost is to us. On the back of Department of Environmental Quality's testimony, we see emissions by sector. We see electricity, transportation, and heating fuels. That's 73% there that are going to be regulated that are big costs to our ranchers, to our farmers, and to all because they bring us a ton of products. If you start regulating Beef Northwest, 35 trucks that move cattle in and out of this state continuously. We see that if the retrofitting and even changes of tires could cost them upwards of $1.5 million just upfront costs. Those will be passed on certainly to our rural sectors, to even Portland retail customers. And so, you know, that's a cost to this state that is going to be very difficult to overcome.
Thank
you. We don't see the benefit.
Thank you, Mr. Welch. Lisa?
Otto? Chair Dingfelder and committee, my name is Lisa Adato. I'm from a group called Climate Solutions, and we are very aware that in order to solve the climate issues, we need to align the solutions to people's real lives. So our organization is dedicated to finding profitable solutions. We think the answer is in innovation, and innovation does create new. And today I've heard quite a bit of fear and a lot of concern about the costs involved. But I did want to make a couple of points, particularly about the low-carbon fuel standard. One is that the testimony that we've heard today is about fuels that really aren't more expensive than gas. So I'm not convinced in any way that this is a cost increase through low fuels. Electric vehicles typically are about half the cost of gasoline vehicles, and they're available for farms as well as for the rest of us drivers. We heard testimony today from Plastifuel about crude oil that can be made in a low-carbon manner from waste products that's $44 per barrel versus $60 for gas. So I'm not convinced that it is more costly. As a matter of fact, the testimony is that we have cheaper fuels available. We do pay $9 billion that goes out of Oregon for oil that we import from foreign countries. There's an advantage to us to keep some of that money in Oregon. Also, the cost of gasoline has gone up. Last summer, it was at over $4 a gallon, and it's going up again. So by creating more competition, more options, we can actually keep the cost of gasoline down. And we know there's a real pain because of fuel costs. More competition will keep those costs down. And we've heard the testimony about local jobs as well. So the economic arguments, I think, are very compelling in favor of this bill, and we would like to support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dotto. And last, Ms. Hagerbaumer.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hagerbaumer. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Environmental Council. Thanks for having me here today. We obviously support House Bill 2186. You have my written testimony, so I'll just touch on a couple of points and a few responses. One thing is that these strategies really didn't come out of the blue. They've been studied and recommended by stakeholder processes that have been underway since the early 2000s in Oregon. Second is that the low-carbon fuel standard is really a market-based approach to promoting new fuels and lower-carbon fuels. It sets the standard, and it allows those who are providing fuel to Oregon to meet that standard in the least cost way. It is different than a renewable fuel standard because the renewable fuel standard only relates to biofuels. What this does is allow any type of fuel that's lower carbon, that works, that's cost effective, to become part of the mix. And Lisa mentioned electricity, the Plastifuel type of thing, and other things that will be developed in the future. Our technology is changing rapidly. One important thing to note, we're reaching, if we have not already reached peak oil production, the market dictates that our petroleum is going to become ever more expensive. And there's a serious environmental issue associated with what we're doing now, which is turning to fuel produced from tar sands and oil shale. And although we don't do that here in Oregon, we do that elsewhere, Canada and so on, and those have incredible environmental impacts. Just a couple of other points. On the issue of how these truck standards would be implemented, the rules would not apply to trucks where it's not cost-effective to do this. So, say, a farm vehicle that drives very little is not going to be subject to these types of rules. And then another important thing, you hear about this authority of DEQ. We think it's an appropriate distinction between legislative and regulatory authority. It allows DEQ to undertake this rulemaking. They're very open. They involve stakeholders. They do a cost-benefit analysis that is very serious and rigorous.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Hagerbaumer. Any questions?
Just a record, Madam Chair. In all the regulations I've put up with for the last 20-some years as a businessman here, when it comes to economic analysis, the state has said, well, we think you can economically do it because we said so. So.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you very much. And anybody else that wants 2 minutes? All right. Thank you. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2186.
Measure 57.
Close the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee.